And so I'm curious, I wonder also about, you know, just the situation. It's normally kind of thought, oh, husband and wife, they collaborate well, you know, the husband's at this level and the wife is a research assistant or a postdoc or, you know, that sort of thing. And whether you've had much kind of, if you've dealt with these issues kind of on a, again, a conscious level, or it's really not been, and it's just turned out all this way.
The issues of women and minority in science? Or, I think that wasn't a conscious effort to do that. It's actually something that I'm amazed at, that I definitely see labs, heads of labs, not comfortable taking women. Mm-hmm. I've never had that feeling, so I think it's almost like the reverse, that where women feel that they're going to be comfortable, they you know, and probably there aren't many labs.
I was going to say, actually, you have perhaps even at some points you've had where, of course,
I've had points where I had more women than men, for example. I have minority people in my lab.
Find each other for other reasons.
The other thing is, I mean, a reason that women can be discriminated against in science is many lab heads are very aggressive in that...
You mean in general, in the way they are as men, or...?
No, in the research activities, and they look at women as with some uncertainty in terms of... Well, can they be as aggressive as men in research, mm-hmm. and are they as committed long term? And, you know, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if women don't make it up in science, maybe they're not as aggressive, and if they're not as aggressive, I don't want to take them in my lab. Maybe they bail out when they get pregnant. Maybe they bail out when they get married and they move with their spouse. You know, we always look at the woman as the one giving in, mm-hmm. in any... you know, family situation. And I think until that changes, it's going to be very difficult to change the perception of women as always the weaker link. And I've heard it from other people saying we don't take women for that reason.
But so you've never ever had like a woman 6 months pregnant come and say, I want to be a postdoc, and you thought, oh, she's pregnant, she's married, this guy, her husband does this. She's talented.
My philosophy is, and that's, I think, how I started my research lab, because I didn't... I mean, Bob Bell is very respected in his field, but that's not a very glamorous lab. And my area of research is obviously, at least for many years, was not glamorous. I mean, we had to build from scratch. My philosophy was to work with every person so that they can execute their potential, mm-hmm. not my expectations. And work with them on that. And I've worked with many people with different kinds of abilities. And, you know, I'm happy with what they achieved. I don't think many of them were superstars, but all of them were committed. They wanted to be scientists, and I helped them achieve their potential. Mm-hmm. And that's made my program successful with whatever I, you know, as long as people were sincere and honest and willing to learn mm-hmm. and work.
Do you think, I mean, I guess, well, I'm coloring that conversation. I guess I see that as not the common way that labs are built. And you don't know enough about other people?
I don't know enough about other people. I see, as I told you, many labs that wouldn't take women, for example, or many labs that wouldn't take except the best student or no student, or the best postdoc or no postdoc. There's obviously a lot of merit to that, because you get the most productivity and the most exciting interaction.
You've got the sexiest topic and you can turn down 30 people, you've got that luxury.
Yeah.
And I suppose if you had a huge waiting list, you'd think about picking about the people who look like...
Yeah, so I mean, let's be realistic. So sure.
And that's how, right?
Yeah, but there's always, I think, room to work with anyone who wants to spend their career in science.
And another thing, and this may be of no interest to you, as somebody who is, I just don't know, would you say that... since your attitude toward women seems to be a lot different than, I guess we're talking about American men or white men or whatever we'll call them. I suppose it almost sounds terrible to call them that. But do you think it's a cultural, I mean, your upbringing, perhaps, yeah, I mean, and politics?
I mean, I grew up in a rather chauvinistic society, but not totally, but I was surprised. I still am surprised that a lot of American men are chauvinistic, basically. It's surprising. Very many men, even in, you know, leadership position, are not comfortable working with women, either as their subordinates or their superiors. I thought, you know, again, growing up and being exposed only to the movie culture of the U.S., I mean, I didn't expect that. But, I don't know, one learns.
And again, your own attitude is, you know, I mean,
we need to.
Yeah, okay. You would just, we'll turn it off. Okay, this is not necessarily, this is going to be it, right?
I think so. How about you?
Yeah, well, in case it is, I just want to say thanks. I just like to get that on tape, okay. Then, especially for what's been a really long time. Well, we're back on. We said goodbye, but we lied. And we will be brief. It's just, I don't, you know, just turning it off because of a time thing is not always the best. We were talking about the women in your lab and just how, you know, you sensed that there were issues facing women, but that you wouldn't ascribe it to some sort of political consciousness on your part, but that it's not much of an issue in your lab. And also, I think that was also a case for non-white, non-American people as well, who, and again, if you look at the list or the roster of your lab, that's the best indication that what you say is true. I think even you, maybe it was off tape, more than 50% are women now, or?
I don't know. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I think now it's 50-50. There were times when there were more women than men, for example. Mm-hmm. I'm also sort of, maybe I didn't mention that, I'm also sensitive because my wife is a professional woman and she senses a lot of prejudice too. So, again, it's something I don't sense. You know, it could be the same situation we're in at the same time, but she senses prejudice that I don't.
Now, prejudice against the both of you or
against her as a woman.
As a woman. Do you, is that something that you think you become sensitized to, or it's still something you just don't pick up on? And, I mean, are you kind of not doubting it, but just, you seem to be taking it seriously, so.
I don't doubt her when she says that. Sometimes I can sense it, maybe because I am sensitized to it, but many times I cannot sense it. It's maybe more subtle. Yeah. Would say that.
There's a common, I think, misperception among people that, you know, I'm not racist or I'm not sexist because I feel I'm not, and they don't understand that actually whether one is or isn't something like that isn't so much of how they feel about themselves, but of course the perceptions of their actions and words as others perceive them.
Yeah.
So.
The one thing I do, I mean, it's, again, I mean, there are many things that I think are not directed against women as such, prejudice against women, but against their level or the role they're assuming at any one time. And then it becomes a catch-22. For example, when I was a more junior faculty, and I would suggest something in faculty meeting, I mean, as if I wasn't in the room. Now I could say a more stupid thing, and everybody listens. And I think also by keeping women sort of at a more junior level, you know, they go through the same thing. That's how I'm describing, because Lena would say, my wife would say that. I was in this meeting, and you know, no one listens to me, as if, you know, they talk, you know, and I wasn't in the room. And I don't know, is it because she's a woman, or she's considered too junior? Mm. And a lot of the prejudice women experience, it's maybe more because either they're in the junior positions, or because they're always assumed that they end up being the ones who compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Especially working married women with children, they get, you know, they don't get paid as much because they're women, or is it because they had to move with their spouse, the spouse got the best job, and they had to compromise.
It's kind of a self-perpetuating.
And it becomes self-perpetuating. And it may be more, and the prejudice may be not more at the workplace as much as the prejudice arising more at the level of the family, that the woman is the one sacrificing other things mm-hmm. for the sake of the family, the husband, the children, keeping the family together. Mm-hmm. Maybe if more men start sacrificing, they will start being this.
I was going to say, have you noticed any? Now you've been in a professional situation since, let's say, med school, so you've been around for a while. Have you noticed, maybe in Beirut wasn't a, I mean, I take it there were women attending, though. Your wife is an, right, she was there. So, maybe it's unfair to add because you spend so much time in a culture that you think is in more ways, not so much sexist, but the relationship or the role of women in that culture tends to not allow so much for comparison between our culture, which is now supposedly not doing things like assigning roles according to gender and whatnot. Okay. The other thing I wanted to ask you, because I think by far the majority of people I'll be interviewing I don't know, white men sounds almost kind of not nice.
Homegrown boys.
Okay, all American, well, American, Caucasian males there. And I would like to take the opportunity with my interviewees who aren't to just ask if they have a sense of feeling outside, like outsiders because of that. I also would like to ask you, because you talked quite a bit at length about that sense you had as an outsider, not, again, being discriminated against so much, but growing up in Beirut as a non-Lebanese.
Well, I mean, in Lebanon, I mean, I could sense that if I had to become a part of society, a productive rather than just a student role, that would have opened a lot of discrimination. I could sense that. I don't think that exists to any comparable degree in the States. I'm still an outsider because, you know, most of my formative years were in different culture or together. So, I mean, I'm missing a lot on the cultural upbringing of, you know, mm-hmm. the other people in society. And there are many things not in my consciousness that are in the American consciousness. So that, you know, forces me to be an outsider. Again, I mean, I've come from, as I said, from a culture where family ties are strong, where societal ties are strong. They're not in this country. It makes it obviously easier to make that switch than the reverse switch. I mean, you mm-hmm. almost cannot penetrate the reverse in the reverse direction. So I do have that perspective of an outsider. And I always wonder what my children will grow up to be. I mean, they seem to be growing up more like totally, you know, American mm-hmm. children, which is fine. I don't see any necessity in giving them the dilemmas and agonies we've been through in terms mm-hmm. of cultural adaptation, although they would probably recognize their heritage and hopefully be proud of it. Mm-hmm. The other part of your question, I guess.
Well, is a sense of
discrimination, is that,
or even just, you know, rude. I mean, just a sense that sometimes you come up against this situation. I am also not unaware of the fact that here I am, a white Caucasian male, asking you this, and I don't want you to think that I'm expecting you to find that there is, and I hope you're not offended that I'm asking the question.
Not at all. I mean, again, I mean, coming from the Middle East, and, you know, the fact that I'm now an American citizen with equal rights
sure.
as anyone else, I'm treated almost as, you know, I think the same as anyone else, with respect, definitely respect for my role and my function. I mean, it's not, if there is a problem, it can't be of any serious magnitude. I do, and I have had the sense, very subtle sense at times, that, you know, had I been a white American boy, I would have had maybe more doors open to me, or open a little easier, or people wouldn't be as apprehensive about, you know, what they're getting into, you know.
How interesting.
And because I'm sort of have come to a more leadership position in academic medicine, I mean, that to me looks like a, you know, an easily explained perspective. If we get an applicant to our program from a foreign, either medical school or undergrad school, either going to medicine, applying for medicine or for the graduate program, you know, if you don't have a familiarity with the program, if you don't with the curriculum, with the degree of accomplishment, I mean, I'm sure that automatically translates into bias. I mean,
or more at a minimum, let's even just say, I mean, obviously, I guess you're suggesting you do it too. If somebody's got a medical degree from maybe somewhere in Europe or something, automatically a flag goes up, and you want to, you're going to give that.
Yeah. How are those people going to do in an American environment? I mean, so I'm sure, therefore, that, you know, I was considered in that light too. I'm sure I assumed that when I was growing through the system, I always, and therefore I assumed consequently that I always had to go the extra step before I can achieve, or I always performed the extra step, whether it was really needed or not, I do not know, but...
Maybe sometimes, or maybe early. I'm wondering now, though, if you were to, like, doing a, sitting on a committee for even a senior position, let's say an associate or even a, you know, a full professor level here in your department, and you were on the committee, and a person whose name was clearly not American came across your desk, and let's say you had the name, because of course it seemed you, it made your, you know, something click in your mind, or you knew that name or had some reason that it stood out, and then you kind of looked through, and indeed the person went to a foreign medical school, and but, you know, they have these list of publications, they're in your situation. Would you kind of drop that flag, in other words, because they've already kind of been, they've gone through this process? In other words, I guess I'm asking about you now. Do you get a sense that you have as much opportunity as... your colleagues who
I would not only drop the flag, but I mean, I also many times in, you know, play the advocate for people coming, you know, from either third world countries or foreigners, especially because I know that having had no opportunities to prove my abilities beyond, you know, just passing the courses, and, you know, I appreciate the degree of achievement. So, and, you know, that's always been my point of view.
Like that they probably went the extra step,
to hematology. That if they're interested in academic medicine, but they've not done anything coming out of even some countries in Europe, it's probably they didn't have the opportunity. Mm. I generalize it, even coming out of, you know, for some reason someone stayed in X college of South Carolina or something, and now they sort of been turned on towards academics, I would give them the benefit of the doubt. I'd be more hesitant, actually, about someone coming from Boston, grew up in Boston, has no academic achievement whatsoever, and now, you know, is coming to be considered for an academic position, either graduate school or fellowship or whatever. That's where actually now I raise the flag, because, you know, someone who's had all those opportunities all along and never exercised them, versus someone who's never had the opportunity, but you could always tell that, hey, whenever they got even the slightest opportunity, they grabbed on it. So, no, I don't think I practice that kind of bias, but what I said...
Oh, yeah, no, I wasn't.
I didn't even the bias, but, you know, in terms of... what I said is I can see how the unknown translates into hesitation. And hesitation is obviously, you know, a minor degree of bias. And And that's why I had always to sort of make sure that I went the extra step. And,
but clearly you've never had a sense that there's, you know, certainly like it's political or there are discussions outside, you know, beyond your, you know, earshot or something about that, or the fact that you...
Yeah, not at all. I mean, you know, remember, I mean, I'm in an academic situation.
Right, and you kind of came into one.
So...
one hopes that usually...
Yeah, one hopes these things don't, you know... And I've been totally unaware of anything like that.
I think regions of the country and actually just traditions in schools, I think also perhaps public versus private situations, there are differences, however. For instance, I think some places are more open to having women really finally climb way up the ladder and take equal positions with men. I remember interviewing somebody, and we tried to come up with women who were like chairs of departments, ran institutes, you know, and had those, you know, the way out question being, when will a woman, you know, run the Whitehead or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And we actually couldn't come up with very many at that time, but I've come up with a few more in just generally reading around. But what is the, you know, would you put, I mean, maybe it's something you're not particularly, you give a lot of thought to, but Duke and its situation, would you say that, I mean, there are a lot of women and that they've kind of come up through the, what do they say now, it's about half and half, you know, PhDs, this is, I don't know about MDs.
But MDs, I mean,
still like
probably,
20%.
No, probably MDs are, 50. Women are a much higher proportion.
Oh, really?
But again, not in leadership positions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Duke doesn't have many women in leadership positions. I would say very few.
Like any, nobody chairing a department in the medical, in any of the medical school or biological science.
No.
Or running a, you know, a lab or a lab with a, you know, a name to it.
Yeah, there are a couple running labs.
And I mean, like, you know, but I guess I'm trying to think of it. Well, I guess I can't really think of it. I guess Ruth Newsom's Weick is actually also chair of the department that she's in, so I won't count that. I was thinking of it like, you know, a lab that's got special funding that may have like 30, you know, lots of PIs in it or something like that, like kind of like an institute within.
Yeah, don't have that, but we only have maybe one or two males who do that.
Yeah.
See, yeah, I mean, again, I mean, I know there's a lot of bias against women in the community at large, but in academia, I think the bias is not conscious bias. There is some of that. I mean, you could see like a faculty member, as I mentioned, being uncomfortable with women, you could tell that this is because of some problem.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the real bias is more subtle, and I really think it's because the successful, quote-unquote, role model in our society, and definitely in academia, is the more aggressive, what you keep mentioning, the 80-hour a week person. And it seems to me that, first of all, I mean, I think this is a myth in terms of that one has to work 80 hours a week to be successful.
Yeah, I'm exaggerating. I realize that,
and
too.
And I would sometimes question, you know, how successful can someone be if they need to work 80 hours a week?
And maybe the determination and aggression or aggressiveness part is of what you're saying is actually a more accurate way of talking about this kind of, what am I, I'm almost stereotyping the biology, you know,
so
the PhD.
Now, that's what people look for when they want to choose a position of leadership, you know, a chairman and a director and a whatnot. And that automatically selects against most women, because most women with families cannot put all their energy into being aggressive about their jobs. It also selects against men who want to be committed to their families. And, unless I was very lucky in setting up my operation and, you know, worked very hard on it, tried to keep it balanced, but I could see that, you know, if any one component of what I was doing fell apart, I wouldn't have moved to where I am now.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole system in terms of moving on to lab operations and leadership is selecting for people with a more aggressive capacity.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's something that is okay? I mean, that's perhaps the way it will always be. Women just have to become more aggressive, or?
Well, I think that's a price for wanting to get results. Mm-hmm. If you want the doers to do things, you know, the doers are the achievers, you know, more aggressive people. If you want to solve the question of male to female ratios, you probably have to solve it as much at home, mm-hmm. and make sure, you know, get it to a point where half the household, the female is the, you know, the person primarily career right. active, and the husband is the one compromising, and the other half vice versa. Mm-hmm. Then you have equal bias both mm-hmm. ways. But to undo the requirement for aggressive sort of male mm-hmm. type characteristics in leadership positions, that's talking about major overhaul of the system. I mean, in terms of how can you get a very laid back person to get, you know, basically, as they say, to crack the whip and mm-hmm. get things going, whether it's a department or I know it's doable. I know it's doable mm-hmm. at the level of individual gifted people. But how do you get the whole system functioning?
Right. You mean, you know, perhaps there are men as well as women out there who are, like, doing some big administrative or whatever sorts of jobs where they're coordinating the work of others more so and kind of keeping it all together, and they're not really
aggressive. They're kind of very effective. They're probably, usually they are the smarter people, mm-hmm. the more self-confident people. Mm-hmm. But they're the exception. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a really, they're going to stay as exceptions because it's a really formidable collection of traits to all put into one person. Mm. So I don't know. I mean, that's really getting into how do you overhaul the whole system. Mm. And I don't know.
No, and we don't want to go too much into what the future looks like beyond your own personal. That's, again, just to round this out and I guess where I would go, and what I'll ask you, and maybe put it this way, what about you know, yourself? Do you see yourself as striving toward running the department or running the institute, or are you going to decide that, oh, after another 5 years, it's going to be your wife's turn to be the aggressive one, and you're going to stay home with the kids a little more, and maybe you'll just kind of be the laid-back type who does his own work, and or you just don't know?
The bottom line is I don't know, mm-hmm. and actually I had a discussion with my chairman last year. He has good insight into that because he's a very effective chairman. He really...
And who is this?
This is Joe Greenfield.
Okay,
and he can... He's a chairman who takes pride in having people grow under him. Mm-hmm. Because if you look around, most chairmen, or many chairmen, many directors, many chiefs, whatever, they're much more out there to protect their own... part of the operation, and actually they can turn to be envious of other people growing in the system. Mm-hmm. So our chairman is very effective from that point of view. And what he said was, because he's been through it, he was a researcher, then head of a division within the department, then head of a department.
Okay, now he's the head of the Department of Medicine.
Medicine, yeah.
Which is really the whole,
the whole internal medicine.
Okay,
it's a few hundred, two, 300 faculty.
Yeah.
But it's the biggest department in the School of Medicine.
Yeah, it's probably one of the biggest departments in the country. But
it's probably as big as all the other departments put together.
Sure.
And he said, you know, you go through phases. And who knows what's the next phase? You may want 10 years from now to say, I've had enough. I've gotten my intellectual stimulation from this. I want to enjoy now having other people grow under me
mm-hmm.
and, you know, take a more administrative job. There is a problem with the system, the way I see it, is in medicine, in academics, the rewards for, you know, doing a good job, at whether it's in clinical medicine or in research, is primarily are given out as administrative jobs.
Yeah.
It's very weird. I think it used to be okay when departments were real small. So it would be out a group of 3, 4, or 5, one would become a chairman. So it was okay.
But they were still obviously doing bench work probably. Even
yeah, but when you talk about a department of a couple of hundred people, that's not okay.
You mean you're not interested in it at all?
At this point.
Yeah. Or,
I mean, the whole system, the way the system rewards, there are very few systems to allow people to grow and, you know, be rewarded by, let's say, staying in basic research. One probably would be the Howard Hughes. Maybe other couple.
Rewards in the sense of just perhaps allowing your lab to expand and more infusion of money.
And grow.
Maybe better, more and more, so you can, buy the boat or take the longer vacation. Yeah,
well, and the security of being in Howard Hughes.
Sure. No more NIH applications don't want to.
I mean, how long can I stay? I mean, what if my next grant gets in trouble for 8 months, you know? That would be a major disappointment. And, you know, how long can I stay with all, you know, they're minor at this point, but they could be more than minor anxieties and irritations and interruptions to my research. You know, there are endowed chairs here and there to do research. I mean, that's obviously one possibility of growth for me. Administratively, I happen to be in a specialty in hematology oncology that to assume any leadership administrative position is almost a kiss of death for my research. Our division is 35 faculty in hematology and medical oncology.
Right. You'd become an administrator. I mean, that's not bad for those who like to do that.
If I want to do it 10 years from now, that may be fine, but it's not something I see myself doing now. I don't know. I mean, the way my wife and I approach this career move when I first set up my lab here was to actually give it 5 years. That was back in late 87. Give it 5 years and see, you know, what turns out with research. I mean, is it going to excite us sufficiently to stay in it or not? So we've passed that sort of landmark or
did
whatever.
Did you also kind of at that point, 5 years, sit down and...
No, we're sort of now in a transition where, you know, we'd like to make some guidelines of what we would consider a satisfying career, maybe in the next 5 years or 10 years.
Does that include maybe not being here, but going elsewhere, or more flexible than
more
that?
More flexible. Define criteria. Like we did the first time, it wasn't really any rigorous criteria. Just, you know, are we going to evaluate what we have achieved as significant or not. It was as simple as that, in a way, and as difficult as that in another way. You know, set up different criteria. And, you know, I think my chairman is right. People evolve as, you know, they grow. And who knows, maybe 5 years from now, I'll be bored with basically, although I really don't see that. I
mean, and running a clinic in Central America.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? 10, 15 years from now, maybe I will find that I would be much more gratified if I do run a clinic in some third world country, especially with my kids all grown up and all set in their own path. I don't know, but there is this discrepancy. So if the next level in, you know, of course, you know, associate professor, next level would be professor, you know, big deal. That's not materially any different, but that's about the limit of growth in what I'm doing now. And it's fine had it not been for the current NIH mess. Mm-hmm. I mean, really sort of doing research with a 10% or lower cutoff point
is a risky business.
It makes it, you know, makes it a risky business. And I don't see myself wanting to take that risk forever. I mean, I know now I'm in a good competitive position for my next round, but I want to do something even, you know, quite crazy and quite innovative and scaled down. And I don't want to be really limited by this 5-year cycle of 10% funding where, you know, if you don't not only conform to the book, but totally excel in every aspect, you feel like you're threatened. That can become a serious consideration. I would not want to be in that for a long time. Had it not been for that, one option definitely would be just to stay as I am and keep doing mm-hmm. it until it really gets to be boring mm-hmm. again, or until, you know, or either I become ineffective at it.
And I take it, I mean, that's, you know, I don't think I'll ask the question except to kind of answer it myself, is that if you look at the short term, you know, it's a matter of you've got young children and you've got an interesting job here, and that's what you'll be doing. And,
yeah, you know, yeah.
That's I take it you were refunded in 92, I suppose, is the year I want to guess, but, right, I mean, the 5 years was up and you... Right, I'm sorry, that's 90. No, it's not. No, you're right.
It's still a couple of years.
You've got 2 years. I'm sorry yeah. to yeah. to raise anxiety where none need be.
I'm not going to be anxious now about it, but you know, it's a symptom of mm-hmm. the troubles of the whole operation. Mm-hmm. You know, so
sure. Okay, I'm. Don't have anything, you know, that's now say this is really, really it. I'm done. Okay. Well, I don't want, I mean, you may, okay, but I think you really are done too.
I'm done. I sort of, yeah. I mean, I wonder what the world's going to be like whenever someone
reads this. I hope they read it. It's a lot different, a lot of different times, and a lot of people read it. I think there's a lot of valuable, and interesting, and even insightful too, which makes it yeah. all the more fun. And I appreciate your time, especially because this is a pretty long one, and
no,
and also the hospitality.
Oh,
okay.